Welcome to A Higher Branch, a source of practical and powerful information for busy people dedicated to boosting their personal health and professional performance. I'm your host, Sam McCall. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of A Higher Branch. Well, what a challenging time we live in at the moment. And it is clear that emotional resilience is such an important quality. And my next guest knows a lot about emotional resilience. And one of my favorite things that she says is that we don't wait for adversity to strike before we go looking for the tool set to deal with these challenges. We need to be working on our emotional resilience continuously throughout life. So when we are faced with challenges, we know how to deal with them at that point in time without having to, you know, go through a series of yo-yo emotions as most of us are going through at the moment. So my next guest is someone that I met at Upgrade Your Life. She had an impact on me. I had so many conversations with so many incredible people, but she was certainly one of the most memorable. And the more I spoke with her, the more I thought I have to have this lady on our podcast. She's the author of an incredible book called How to Be Resilient. She's also an international speaker, and she's worked with large organizations such as Telstra, CSIRO, and Holden. And she's been featured on the ABC. I've read about her on Financial Review and The Australian. And mainly she was featured on those programs for her insights on resilience in the workplace, something that I'm incredibly passionate about because I employ so many staff. So what makes Stacey's approach to resilience different? Because she isn't an academic or a psychologist, but she has created a framework of resilience based on her own life experience of overcoming the adversity of quadriplegia at the sensitive age of only 12 years. She's an incredible woman, and I was lucky enough to not only meet with her, but have her say yes to appearing on our podcast. So on that note, Stacey, welcome not only to this podcast, but to our High Branch community.
It is fabulous to be here, and Upgrade Your Life definitely was a really great experience for me, and it was a great way to start the year, and just to the conversations and the connections that came from that have been really pivotal in getting this year started really well.
Absolutely. Well, for me, I had many highlights at the event, but definitely up there for me, one of my highlights was meeting yourself, and that's why I wanted to meet you. I want to read your book, but more importantly, I want you to share your knowledge and your wisdom with our community, especially during these times where adversity is now rampant, not so much personally, but it's become a collective fear. I'm talking about this coronavirus. And when we're dealing with fear that's rampant like that, it is an adversity, isn't it? But look, for those people who have not met you, do you mind sharing your story of what happened when you were only 12 years of age?
Yeah, so back at 12, it was a pivotal point in my life, and it was, the biggest thing that happened at that point. I was cooling off in a relative's backyard swimming pool with my younger brother, who was 10. Yes. And a couple of other boys who are around the same age, and it was somewhere I'd been before. It was somewhere I was quite familiar with, but being the only girl and being that bit older than them, I was like, meh, don't want anything to do with them. So what I did every time I was there is I used to just climb up on the edge of the pool and just keep diving in. And it was just an above ground pool, so it definitely was not a diving pool,
right?
But it was something that I always did.
Yes.
And so on this day I was doing that, and I was just diving in over and over again, and I was getting yelled at to stop, but being 12 and bulletproof and invincible, I was like, not listening to that. And I just kept doing that, and then just one particular time I ended up standing on the edge of the pool and thinking, I felt like I was splashing too much as I was diving in.
Right.
So I stood there for a moment and I just thought, well, how can I dive without splashing so much? And so I thought that if I tried to keep my legs straighter and hold my feet together, in theory, I thought that would make a nice clean entry into the water. So I took a deep breath and did exactly that. And it felt like any other dive that I'd done before, until I went to try and swim up to the surface and I realized I couldn't move. So I was stuck at the bottom of the pool, holding my breath. I didn't feel any pain, didn't feel like anything had gone wrong, but I just could not move. So I desperately was trying to get the attention of my brother, which I couldn't do. So I held my breath for as long as I could.
So you remember this vividly?
Absolutely vividly, every single moment of that. And, you know, I don't know how long it was, but obviously it felt like an eternity. And it was just sheer panic and terror of trying to, just thinking like I can only hold my breath for so long. And eventually I couldn't hold it any longer.
Right.
And I just had to give in. And as I breathed in and my lungs filled with water, I blacked out. And, you know, eventually my brother realised that I wasn't joking and he pulled me out. And it was only recently I actually had lunch with one of the other guys that was in the pool with me that day, just before Christmas. I haven't seen him for 29 years ago. I hadn't seen him since that day.
Wow.
And it was a really interesting conversation to have with him about his memories of the day. And so he said he remembers so much that they all thought I was just joking and that was like splashing at me. And then, you know, once they realised something was wrong, they pulled me out. And so I got taken to the local hospital and, you know, at the third hospital late that night in intensive care, I ended up having a doctor come and tell me that I'd actually broken my neck and drowned and I'd never walk again. Pretty much I felt like my life was over in that moment. You know, it was the end of the life as I knew it and planned it.
And at that age, you already knew what you wanted to do when you were older.
Yeah.
What was that?
Yeah, I was I guess I was pretty rare in the fact that before I even started primary school, I knew what I wanted to do. And all I wanted to do was be a vet. So all through my schooling, those primary school age schooling, everything was focused on that. And at 12, I was at the end of year six. I went to school here in New South Wales.
Right.
And I'd actually passed the entrance exams and I got a first round offer to go to Hurlston Agricultural, which is a selective agricultural school. So, of course, that was a huge tick on that next step, you know, to being a vet. But aside from that, I was an athlete as well. So
That's right. Yeah,
I played softball. I was a pitcher in the softball team. I was one of the first two girls to ever play soccer for my school. And I was a rep runner every distance from the 100 metres to the cross country.
Up until that point, had you had any other defining moments in your life? And I call them defining moments because you recall at Upgrade Your Life, we talked about defining moments.
Yeah, with Guy Winch.
Yeah,
yeah.
Guy Winch, David Goggins talked about it. I talked about my two defining moments. So obviously that is a huge defining moment for someone, right? How did you deal with that adversity at the time, being only 12? Was it easier or harder at that age?
In hindsight, once I was in my teens, I definitely thought I had it easier compared to most. Because I had a stint in hospital in my late teens, and it was there that I became more aware of the other people that were there. And I was seeing, particularly I think the people that I thought probably had it a hell of a lot worse than I did, was the guys in their 30s that had families, that were tradies with their own businesses, that had mortgages, and all of those levels of responsibility. Whereas the only thing I had was focus on me at that point in time. So I really feel that it was probably it's never a good time to have something like this happen. But I felt if anything was going to happen, it was probably a really good time for that to happen.
Because I've heard you say that was the best thing that ever happened to you.
At the beginning, as I said earlier, I felt like my life was over because I was like, okay, I can't be a vet. I can't walk, let alone run to play all the sports I used to do. And my identity at that point was athlete and that I was going to be a vet.
So
that
you
was
lost it. Your identity.
I lost my identity. And so, and being 12, I was just about to go into high school. Like that point in time is so, there's so much stuff
that
happens.
Cool.
Identity is so huge. We're always at that point, we're trying to find our way. We're trying to figure out where we fit in, why we're here, you know, the dynamics we have with other people. And so I had that, you know, as well as this. And so I ended up spending 7 months in hospital. So I missed the first 6 months of high school. I couldn't go to that selective agricultural high school. It wasn't accessible. I needed support. So I ended up getting shipped off to a school nowhere near where I lived. I didn't know a single soul and I rocked up there in the middle of the year. So that was challenging in itself. So in those first few years, probably the first even 3 to 5, I would have given anything to have either turn back the clock and not taken that dive or to have not been there at all.
Because a lot of people would go there, wouldn't they?
Sure.
What if I didn't?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, that rumination that Dr. Guy Winch talks about. Did you? How long did you ruminate for? And you did confess to me that you went through some depression and you became suicidal at one stage. When did that happen? And what led to it at the time?
Yeah, look, my way of coping through those years was...
And I'm sorry if I'm bringing these emotions back out again.
Oh, no, it's real. And it was something that I really didn't share with anybody until into my 30s, until I wrote my book. Like, I was so... I kept all of it to myself, which wasn't healthy. But, yeah, I spent a lot of my teenage years drunk and stoned. By doing that, I was trying to seek these moments of artificial happiness.
Yes.
And what that led to in between was getting deeper and darker into the despair and the anxiety and the self-loathing in between. Yes, yes. And it did get to a point where I didn't want to be here at all. And, you know, in hindsight, what I realised is that, you know, physically I drowned once, but emotionally I was drowning every single day most of those years. So it was definitely a super challenging time. And as I said, it was one of those things that I completely kept it to myself.
So was your turnaround a gradual thing, or was there another defining moment where you just said enough?
There was two things that I sort of saw during that time. The first one was what stopped me from getting stoned all the time. I was at the point where I was actually getting stoned at school.
Yep.
I had a couple of moments where I was so stoned I couldn't speak at school, and I had friends cover for me and all that sort of stuff. And I just got to the point where I'm like, this is ridiculous. I was getting foggier and foggier, and I'm like, it's got to stop. So that was when I was about 16, so year 10. So pulled the pin on that. And then a little bit later in high school, I had my real rock bottom moment where I found myself alone at home and just so desperate for, you know, just the pain and the self-loathing and that just to go. And I found myself with, you know, a bottle of prescription medication and a bottle of water. And the only thing that stopped me in that moment from doing that was the fear that someone would find me before I was gone and I would end up worse than where I was.
Yeah, totally get that. And when you say somebody, is that you're talking about your parents, siblings?
Yeah, anyone. You know, that was the fear. And if I had had a guarantee at that time that that wouldn't have happened, I wouldn't be here today. So I'm really glad that voice had sort of come and did that.
Where do you think that voice came from? Is that your inner essence fighting?
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess so in that sense. And it was that what it did for me, though, was it scared the life. It nearly scared the life out of me. But it was one of those things that, you know, it scared me so much, because you never ever think that you will find yourself personally in a situation where you're contemplating that. You know, there's a lot of judgment, from society around, you know, suicidal thoughts and things like that. And people have a judgment of like, how can anything be so bad that you would contemplate that? And so finding myself in that situation, that was the real shift to go, look, this is proverbial fork in the road. You've either got to get on with it, you know, give up or get on with it.
Absolutely. And I don't think a lot of people realize that how fine our life rests in the balance, and that we can all get there very, very quickly, you know, through a series of events, one event, two events. And I recently did a course on safe driving, and because I'm one of those people that loses their license every now and then, I think the government said, enough, you have to go do a course. And I begrudgingly turned up to this course. I think I told the guys recently this story, but it keeps coming back to me, because listening to your story reminds me of one of the stories that I watched during this course, where this person had the ordinary life, then his brother had a car accident and died. And then his other brother became depressed and committed suicide. And it's funny how our life can just shift in an instant. And we need to be prepared. We need to... most people rush to being resilient when they need to. But your message is you need to prepare yourself for life. You need to be always in a state of practicing resilience and knowing how to deal with adversity. And... really, that's what I want to talk to you about, because I think really, a lot of young people need to hear this as well. I think resilience is the number one skill that we need to be teaching people and young people. You know, not trigonometry, not Shakespeare. There's so much, you know, emphasis on, you know, all these things external to us, but not enough about, you know, the internal, what's going on in our internal world. And we should never put ourselves in a position where our whole world can be rocked from one event. We've got to be able to take the body blows that life throws at us. So I want to talk to you about that. And one of the things you say is gratitude is the key to success. And I love that. If you remember that, I talked about gratitude a lot at Upgrade Your Life, because it's the perfect antidote to unhappiness.
Yeah, completely.
And even depression, right? So what can you tell us about the way you practice gratitude and the way you teach it?
Yeah, and gratitude for me, that was the key point going back that enabled me to really get on with it. And part of that was shifting the way that I looked at the accident. And I actually started to look at it, and I looked at it with gratitude. And I was grateful that I had that accident and how it changed my life.
So how did you reframe it then?
Exactly like that, is I just reframed it, that I was grateful that I had the accident and I was grateful for how it changed my life.
So do you want to just talk, just take us through the self-talk that goes on how to reframe something from an apparent tragedy to it's the best thing.
Yeah, and it basically it's a choice. And a lot of people will turn around and go, it's not that simple. And I'm like, actually it is. It is actually really, really simple. Doesn't mean it's easy, but it was just simple. And so it was just, was actually doing that. And again, most people go, how the hell does ending up a quadriplegic and needing a wheelchair for the rest of your life positive? But I can say with absolute certainty that I've had the most incredible experiences since then, and especially since I reframed the way I looked at it, that I would have never had if my life had have taken a different path. But yeah, gratitude is a lot of the time we hear about, you know, writing down the things you are grateful for.
Yes.
And sometimes I find that can be a little bit challenging for people. So for me, I use mantras, and that's what I've ended up doing. And so it started out, my gratitude process has evolved over the years. And it just used to start off with, is this just like I'm grateful for, you know, where I am and what I have.
Yes.
And that has now ended up being that every night, you know, each night when I close my eyes, when I go to bed, I repeat, you know, my gratitude mantra. And also if I find myself in a rut during the day. And so, you know, usually it's just the first line of it, which is thank you for the opportunity to be who I am, where I am, with what I have at this moment in time. And that gets you grounded in the moment right now.
I love that. Let's break that down.
Yeah.
There's quite a few elements there. There's four elements.
Yeah. So it's grateful for who I am.
Yes.
And everything about who you are. Then there's the where I am, and there's the what you have at this moment in time. And I think that's really the key point, is it's at this moment in time. Because if we are completely in the moment, we can't feel anxious.
Yes.
Because anxiety is the thought about what's coming ahead.
Yes, okay.
I don't believe we can feel depressed in the moment either, because depression's more about what's happened in the past.
That's right, it's regret.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if we can ground ourselves in the moment at any given time, then it eliminates those two things.
Very powerful. So depression lives in the past, anxiety lives in the future. And there's a lot of anxiety going on in the world today about what the future could bring for people's health. So how would you reframe that?
Yeah, I still think gratitude is super important in this moment, because again, so much of what's happening is about what might happen. And I read recently, again, because people are getting so fixated on the media and the news at the moment,
right,
and that's feeding the fear. And one of the questions that came up is, it's like, how can you tell if something's news? Something is news if it's reporting on something that has happened.
Yes.
If it's speculating or may happen, it is merely an opinion. So people need to look at the lens of that when they're
absolutely
actually looking
it's
at,
a
is
very
this
good
news?
Distinction. Yeah.
Yeah. And even at any time, I find is that if something is really feels overwhelming and challenging, it is just coming back to that, I'm grateful. I may not feel it right now, but even just by the message we tell ourselves, we can shift that. So it brings it back into the moment. And then there's a few other lines that I use with the gratitude as well. It's I'm grateful for all of the experiences I've had, the lessons I've learned, and the people I've met. Because that's one of the things that I always find gratitude is so much about. The journey we've had, even if it has not been what we wanted, we've got people in our lives that would not have been there, again, had our life taken the path that we had designed.
Absolutely. Now, who is the person that you've met on that journey that has had the most impact on your life?
Oh, wow, there's been quite a few, actually. But I think the one that has made the biggest difference has been in more recent times. And that was Lane Beachley. You know, she's been an amazing, an amazing person. And I came to her through her foundation, which she used to, which unfortunately wound up the foundation now. But for many, many years, she ended up, was 500 women that over the years that she supported financially and with mentoring. And it was all about women that were already doing great things to help them.
Yes.
Reach higher levels. So having someone like her who has an incredible journey herself to show belief in what I'm doing and what I was doing, that was super powerful. And then that brought me into an amazing community and things like that as well. So, you know, she's been somebody that's been really good. And again, I was someone that I admired from afar. And then being able to then have a personal connection with her was amazing. So
what is the one thing that she teaches that had the biggest impact on yourself and others? What was that quality that she had, or that message rather?
Yeah, I think the big thing for me was, again, just that having that belief in yourself and being okay to actually stand out. Because I think what I've experienced, I think, yeah, in Australia, tall poppy syndrome is such a huge challenge. And I think for women, it's even more challenging. So to actually then be able to put your hand up and celebrate your success publicly, that was a big one. Because I know I grew up in Western Sydney. It was one of those things that it was like, don't stand out, don't say that you're good at anything. People will think you're a big head. There's always that cutting down. So we grew up minimizing ourselves and our success. So coming into her community, it was a matter of going, you got to stand out, you got to shine. You know, the foundation was called Aim for the Stars. So it was about doing that and really owning your stuff and being proud of it.
I love that. Why do you think that element is still there in Australian society? I think in the world, actually.
It's actually way more prevalent in Australia. It's from people I've spoken to. I think England has got a little bit of it as well.
Yes.
But I guess there's probably a link considering that we're colonised by the British.
Well, it is a regal quality to, you know, stay modest, under the radar. And Meghan Markle's experiencing that at the moment, because in royalty you're supposed to just, you know, stay quiet and humble and not speak out. But that goes against a lot of what we're hear from, you know, motivational gurus or inspirational people who say, you know, shine brightly. And especially women, I think, are being told to stand up and, you know, assert themselves. But the moment they do, they get chopped down. So it's a bit of a tug of war going on with the two mixed messages.
It's really hard. And also, too, a lot of the challenges with women is it's other women, unfortunately, that are the ones that are probably the worst at cutting each other down. And that was something that through Lane's Foundation, it was probably the first solely woman-focused organisation I'd been a part of, that everyone was genuinely had each other's backs. It was the best mutual admiration society, and everyone did. Everyone was inspired by each other. No one was threatened. No one saw each other as competition. Everyone was genuinely backing each other. And even now, years later, like, I've got the most amazing friendships and relationships from that group of people, and I know that I could pick up the phone to any one of them now or another 5 years down the track, and I know that they will still have my back.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you found your tribe.
I found my tribe. And then obviously I found my new tribe as far as the, you know, the Higher Branch community as well.
Yeah.
You know, with coming into Upgrade Your Life, which as I was looking for, you know, that tribe and that, you know, community of like-minded people. So I'm very grateful that I've found that now.
Yeah, I'm grateful for it too. There was a definite click in the room, wasn't there, between everyone?
100%.
Yeah. I read somewhere that you haven't missed journaling in 4 years.
Almost five now.
Almost five.
Yeah.
Okay.
Most of a single day.
Why is it important for building resilience and dealing with adversity? And why do you keep doing it? Why? What's the payoff for you? For someone that's listening that might have, you know, a job, demanding job, a partner, two kids, mortgages, school fees. I know what they're thinking. It's like, I don't have time to journal, right? Now, I journal maybe 2 or 3 minutes in the morning, sometimes 5 minutes. Now, if I've had a shitty day and I need to process a lot of things, I might actually process a lot of feelings and it might take me 20 minutes of journaling. But the main thing is to do it every day.
Yeah.
So what drives you to do it, has driven you to do it every day for the last 5 years?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like I got into journaling probably about 6 years ago. And I hadn't journaled since I was in primary school. Now, what was really interesting about my primary school journaling is when I was in hospital for those 7 months, the thing that I was worried about more than what I was going through was my parents finding my journal at home.
As a teenager, you would, yeah.
And what almost breaks my heart now when I think about it is I still remember the first time I went home after being in hospital, the first thing I did was I went and found that journal. I ripped it into tiny little pieces and threw it in the bin.
Why? Why did you do that?
I was so fearful about if anyone read it.
To know your feelings.
Yeah. Where I was up, where I was at, what I was up to, yeah. Like all that sort of stuff. It was, yeah. And I did not journal again until my mid-30s. Like that was... And so then I got back into journaling and I just started with... keeping it simple, because again, I think this is, as you touched on, so many people have got busy lives and they're thinking, well, this is just one more thing. But the way I came to journaling was to just go, look, I'm going to keep it really simple. And it was about the consistency was the key. So I started with a commitment to do it 90 days, no exception. And what I did was it was two things. I either just answered the question, what was the best thing that happened today? And sometimes to prompt that, I would start with a cue of today I had the opportunity to.
Right,
and finish the sentence. And so my commitment was one sentence. If it went beyond that, that was fine, but that was my commitment. And I had nights where I actually realised I'd got to bed and I'd realised I hadn't journaled. So I actually got back out of bed. And for me, that's not easy.
Yes.
I got back out of bed and then did the journal. I do it electronically, my evening journals.
Yes.
So I did that and then would get back into bed. And I did that multiple times. So that first stint, I did 15 months-ish without a break of one day. And that was super powerful. Then I dropped the ball a little bit. I probably did it once a week. And then once I was doing some book launch stuff and journaling came up again, and I thought, okay, I need to live and breathe exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I haven't missed a day in that. And sometimes for me, it was about processing. Sometimes it was just about capturing. But as you mentioned too, when you've really got some emotional stuff going on, that journal can get pretty lengthy. I've had nights where I've written 2,000, 2,500 words because I've been processing.
But is that a form of therapy, self-therapy?
Oh, yeah. I kind of a little bit jokingly say sometimes, but it's true, that journaling has probably saved me tens of thousands of dollars in therapy over the years.
Yeah.
That's how I process. It's
absolutely,
and no, it's capturing that stuff. Yep. And what I love too about the program that I use is after you've journaled for a period of time, it's got a feature called the Looking Glass. So if you enable that, I get an email every night that says, on this day, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago, this is what you wrote.
Ah, yeah,
which is really fascinating because it's like it usually elicits one of two things. It either elicits, wow, look how far I've come. Or, bloody hell, I had all the answers then and I still haven't done anything with it. So it's super powerful. And it's, just think it's just a commitment to one sentence every day. But yeah, it does help to process. It helps you to capture, to reflect, to even just pose questions. Sometimes I just put questions in there. But I always do it before I go to bed because then that clears my head. So I'm not laying there when I'm going to sleep thinking or processing. I've already done that processing before I go to bed.
I love that because... The important thing about that is that your conscious mind doesn't always have the answers, but by writing the question down, your subconscious goes to work on it at night.
Yep.
Because I've found that has happened to me a few times. As I write the question, wake up in the morning with the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or at 3 o'clock in the morning in the bathroom. I find that often I'll be 3 o'clock in the morning going to the bathroom. I'll come back into my room. I'll grab my phone. I'll grab Evernote. And I've written a few hundred words, which has either been an outline for, you know, a blog or a series of questions or just like, wow, this is, it just seems to, you get these downloads in the middle of the night.
Yes.
So I just get them out of my head and then I go back to sleep. So I never want to lay down with something on my mind.
Yep. I really like that. So I'm not the only person that does that, wakes up at 3.
Oh, the best ideas come through at 3 a.m. in the bathroom.
I always get the nudge from my wife saying, go back to sleep.
It's like that.
Now, one of the quotes you have is focus on what and why and the how will take care of itself.
Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think so.
How does the how take care of itself? Does it just appear or...?
Well, it's kind of linked to what we just talked about sometimes posing those questions and letting the subconscious go to work. But yeah, a lot of the time is that people don't do things because they don't know how.
Yes.
And, you know, that happens. So yeah, I think when we get stuck in when we get stuck on the how, then that's the time to go back and go, well, what is it?
Yes.
And why do you want it? And I think it's those things. Obviously, Simon Sinek's talked about so much about the, you know, the power of, you know, start with why.
I haven't come across someone with one single message, talk so much about it and write so much about it.
I know. He's done well, hasn't he? Yeah.
But I love the way he's probably one of the best speakers, actually, I've ever come across, Simon Sinek, and he does it with so much passion and intensity that it just sticks with you. So keep on doing what you're doing, Simon. So what is your what, your current what and why?
Yeah.
What's your biggest
why? Yeah, look, I go back to the why.
Yeah.
The why is so powerful now. For me, I feel a deep moral responsibility to keep doing what I'm doing because I know that, especially in the world today, there's a lot of people that are struggling, a lot of people that, you know, may not really pursue what deep down they want to do because of fear or all of those things. But the real thing, the reality is there is it's all about getting people to really tap into who they are and get past all their excuses of why not and then be able to focus on, you know, doing what they really want. And just knowing that through sharing my story and being able to share a few key messages, it's any time I speak, I'm always thinking about that one person that's in the room that I know that if I don't show up completely present and at my best, that whatever that thing that is going on in their world is not going to change. But if I show up 100% with me, you know, with complete connection with that person, with that room, then I know that I can help shift something in their life that could change the entire trajectory of their life.
I love that.
So I feel so responsible now to do that. And also that it's not about me now, because I never wanted to do this because I was so worried about what people would think about me.
Yes.
And I realized it wasn't about me. I had a mentor that said, look, it's not about you, it's about them. And if you don't share your story, you're being selfish. And once I started doing that and I just got to see all these people that say, well, because you said that, I did this. And the emails and the messages I get 3, 4, 5 years later that people said, you helped me do this.
And that's your big why.
That's it, is to keep doing that. Is to get people to get out of the entitlement mentality, just to, you know, really focus on themselves and the impact they can have. And we all have influence. And I think this is a big thing. And people don't realize that no matter who you are, you've got influence of some description. And helping them to realize that they've got that and to use it. For me, one of the things I always think of, I always believe the best is yet to come. So, you know, there always needs to be something pulling us into the future.
Yeah.
In a positive way. Yep.
So that's one of the things you keep telling yourself is the best is yet to come.
Always. I always believe that. And I've had amazing experiences so far, but that having that perception the best is yet to come helps keep you going every single day.
Yeah, I really like that. One of the things that you do really well with business leaders is that you teach them how to have difficult conversations with people. So tell us about that, because I employ quite a few staff and sometimes you need to have these difficult conversations. So what's the best way of doing that?
Yeah, I find the best way of doing that is to not just wait until there's a difficult conversation that needs to be had to have a conversation at all. Because so often, especially when, you know, everything's so fast-paced, there's a tendency to have your conversations usually at times where it might be an appraisal thing going on and that sort of stuff.
Yep.
So I encourage all leaders and anyone that's working with people in general is to have frequent informal conversations with their staff all the time, at least once a week, to have an informal conversation. And it can be just a few questions. It can be just like, you know, hey, how are you feeling at the moment? What are you working on? What challenges are you having at the moment? How can I best support you? And so if you have those conversations all the time, you build trust.
Yeah.
And then when it does come to having those challenging conversations, generally, if you're having those conversations frequently, it doesn't get to the point where you have to have a really challenging conversation.
That's absolutely true, yeah.
Yeah, because those little things are going to be, you'll get an indicator that something's happening through there. And because you've got that rapport and that trust, then you can start to have those conversations early. Rather than if you are, you know, a person that's, you know, very removed from their lives, then it is very difficult to then go and have those conversations. Obviously, they still need to be had.
Yes.
But I think that's the best way to do it. And it also just creates that trust, that sense of community. You get to know people. You get to know what motivates and inspires them as well. And then you can be a cheerleader for them, and you get to know what their motivators are, so then you know how to work with those people better as well.
I think there are some businesses and business leaders and senior executives who don't like to get too close to people. And I think it's a bit of a shame because, you know, a lot of people say business is not personal. Don't take it personal, it's just business. For me, business is personal. And I think the reason why we've been successful, because I do get to know my leadership team, my people very well, my clients. And because ultimately we're humans and we don't just leave our humanity at the door in business. And the people that I know that have customers and clients who are the best at their game are the ones that have a personal relationship with their clients, whether they're lawyers, you know, mortgage brokers, real estate agents. And so I think we need to move away from that old, you know, principle of, oh, you know, don't get too close. If you don't, you're always going to have a business that's numb. It's just ticking along, it's textbook stuff. So I really love what you just said then. And you never have to have a difficult conversation if you're always checking in and connecting with people from the heart.
It makes them feel that they feel valued and seen.
Yeah.
And because that's one of the things that comes up a lot in business is why people leave places, is because they don't feel that they're valued or that their work is meaningful or things like that. So if you can always be through those conversations, helping them to connect with the importance they have to the overall, then that really helps people to actually, and especially when times are tough, it helps people to go, well, look, you know, we'll keep pushing through this because there's a greater thing at play here. And a lot of it's all about being proactive. And again, that's why my approach to resilience is proactive. It's all about building these skills so that when something happens, you're not completely blindsided by it. Because unfortunately, particularly in a business context, I've come across so many situations where they have an approach to resilience where it's just become synonymous with coping.
Yes.
And it is reactive. And it's like that's
exactly what I was talking about when we first opened.
And it's not a great approach because again, we can't just sit back and wait for stuff to happen.
Yes,
we need to be ready for it, and then also look at it with optimism and looking at all these things, all this adversity and this change, as looking at it with through the lens of opportunity and possibility, rather than disaster and doom and gloom.
Absolutely, love that. So what brought you to Upgrade Your Life? Was it Goggins?
Actually, I came across Upgrade Your Life through Jim Quick.
Oh, okay.
It was through Jim. So did one of his programs online many, many years ago.
Yes.
So I follow Jim's social media. And yeah, sort of into late last year, I really felt that, you know, I work on my own a lot and you know, you feel a bit isolated. So for me, it was about looking for a community, looking for a tribe, looking for looking for where I could spend time with like-minded people. And so I decided, probably about October, it was just after I came back from the US, I decided that I was going to look for a couple of, I thought, really high quality multi-day events that, you know, it wasn't so much about the speakers, it was more about the community. And obviously then I came and got completely blown away by the speakers as well. But yeah, that was what brought me there.
The reason why I say that is because a lot of the things you say have parallels to what David Goggins says.
And so
a lot of the stuff in your book as well.
And when I was listening to David's book, I was like, oh, we're so aligned. And that was the conversation I had with David. And it was just our whole approach. And even to the point where, you know, both of us, you know, we're not academics or psychologists. We haven't researched all this stuff. We've just lived it. And so my approach is it's backed by life rather than backed by science. And I share that with David. And, you know, we definitely bonded over that. And you know, having David, you know, toughest man in the world, label me a badass, I was like,
I'll wear
that with pride.
Yeah, absolutely. So can I just have a look at your book there?
Absolutely. There we go.
So the book is simply called
How to Be Resilient, exactly what it says on the can.
And I love how-to books because for me it's about key takeaways. So where can people get a copy of this book?
Any of your local bookstores, Amazon, online ones. If you like the physical books, otherwise you can get the audio and the ebook from howtoberesilient.com.
And is it your voice on the audio?
It is.
Oh, wonderful. That's good.
Yes.
I have this thing. I really need to hear the author's voice. Yeah, that's really, really good. I haven't actually read the whole book. I've read snippets from what I've seen online. So thank you for bringing this in. I hope this is for me.
It absolutely is for you.
And, so thank you very much for coming on our High Branch podcast. I'm hoping you'll be a regular contributor.
I would absolutely love to.
That's awesome. All right, guys. Well, that's all from us this week at A Higher Branch. Live consciously, my friends.